Okay, the first question is, in what ways might a loving and affectionate father still fail to deposit the proper funds in his daughter's bank, and how can he guard against this while his girls are still young? How does this affect his authority when the time for courtship comes?
Okay, that's a great question, because there are fathers that I've encountered who have a great relationship with their daughter. They're warm and they're affectionate, and yet the daughter gets into trouble and the dad's not able to do anything about it. This is not able to write the check, as I was using yesterday. I would say that this is a problem that comes up when I'm dealing with a young lady who's in some sort of serious difficulty, and her father wants to do something but is not in a position to do something. These are just ballpark numbers, obviously, but I'd say 80% of the time is because dad was neglectful, distant, harsh, that sort of thing. 20% of the time, it's because he is a very, very nice squish. He is the one that she has gone to her whole life. If she doesn't want to get a no for an answer, he has done nothing but indulge her. And so consequently, she thinks, oh, he's just wonderful. He's great. We get along great. But she's thinking of him as a sugar daddy. She's not thinking of him as a father. One of the things daughters need is the security of boundaries. They need a father to be a father, but it has to be a father who's functioning in the context of love and care. So there are fathers who are harsh, distant, aloof. They set boundaries. They do nothing but set boundaries. You know, that's the lion's share of the problem. But there are fathers who set no boundaries, and they do it all for the sake of being warm and approachable and so forth. So what a father needs to do is he needs to make sure that he is providing boundaries and direction and security without being harsh, and he's got to be kind and loving and tender without being a walkover. Okay, that's the balance. And in my thinking, the God the Father, the Garden of Eden provides the boundary, provides the pattern. In the Garden of Eden, it was a world full of yes. It was a world full of yes and one no. And that one no, God said, meant what he said. And when they transgressed, the roof fell in. It was, God didn't say, well, I'll give you 2 out of 3 tries, or I'll count to 10, you know. You see a parent counting to 10 in Walmart, you know, kids flipping out. Our family calls them Walmart kids, you know, kids flipping out, and the parent, exasperated parent, says, I'm going to count to 10, 9, 9.5, 9 3/4. You're not teaching obedience, you're teaching fractions. So that would be basically what I'd say, is it's a balance. You want a father who is a velvet-covered brick. And he's tough at the center, he enforces the boundaries, but the boundaries are reasonable and few. The boundaries are reasonable and few. It's not a host of commandments. I remember vividly with my own dad, there were three rules in our house. And I can remember where I was standing in the front yard when my dad laid them down. He said, there's no lying, no disobedience, and no disrespecting your mother. No lying, no disobedience, and no disrespecting your mother. You do that, this household's going to run smoothly. And so it's very simple. Life is simple. In the Garden of Eden, there was one restriction, but everything else was a yes. I urge parents to create a climate of yes with enforced, definable boundaries that are genuinely enforced. And that's what a father can do, particularly with his daughter. Okay. I'll leave out the history here, but just this is a question about social media. Is social media a tool or a trap for families? How does your church deal with Facebook and others? Just a couple of things about that. I'm actually tempted get an elder whose full pastoral responsibility is to cruise Facebook and to find out how everybody's doing. And the answer is, with some of them, not very well. And the Facebook, I think that basically technology, every form of technology, social media included, is simply a form of wealth. And the Bible doesn't tell us anything about technology. You can't look up computers or social media on your Bible search software. You can't look it up in an old-fashioned concordance. You can look up wealth, riches. Basically, if I had to explain to George Washington what this thing can do, he would think I was a wizard and demon-possessed, right? How many servants of the old style would it take to be able to perform these functions and look up things, the libraries I can carry around? I'd have to have 100,000 servants, and I carry them around in my pocket, and of course, 90,000 of them are just sitting around doing nothing. Because I don't know how to coordinate them. But the point is, it's obviously, self-evidently, a form of wealth. And the Bible teaches that wealth has a bias. The bias of wealth is to veer into self-sufficiency, pride, insolence, forgetting God. That's what all wealth does. Nice houses do that. High income does that. Social technology, all of it has that bias. At the same time, the Bible teaches that wealth is a gift of God, right? It's a fallen world, so most sinners abuse wealth, but it's a gift of God nonetheless, and we are required to honor God with what we do and what we have. So, you know the old saying where, if you put 1,000 monkeys at 1,000 keyboards and had them type aimlessly, eventually they produce the collected works of Shakespeare. Well, now, thanks to the internet, we know that's not true. All the internet does, you might be tempted to say, is enable us to move our ignorance around the world at high rates of speed. You know, we can be dumber faster, right? So it used to be, when you were dumb, it took the community 3 days to find out. And now it takes 3 minutes to find out that you're being dumb. So that's the first thing. But if you receive it as a gift of God, if you receive it as a gift of God, it doesn't detach you from community. It connects you. So for example, when my wife and I go up to Spokane and we're hanging out, and she can text the kids and she can be shopping and she can say, oh, I wonder if one of the granddaughters would go with this, and she can take a picture of it and email it to the daughter-in-law. Would like me to pick this up? And you have this constant conversation. It can weave your family tighter, right? It can weave your family tighter. It's like wealth, any other form of wealth. If you abuse it, it's going to fragment you, drive you farther apart. If you receive it as a gift of God and say, how can I use this to edify others? How can I use this to build others up? It's a very good, very, very good thing, social media included. Is it social media a tool or a trap for families? It's both. Right? It's both. If you just send your kids out into the internet unsupervised, that's like sending them over to the bad side of town without anybody watching them. You just don't do that. You just don't do that. But if you're engaged and talking with them, and you can talk with them even more effectively. This Nancy didn't accompany me on this trip, and so we can text back and forth, and it's a whole lot more convenient than 20 years ago. What if I had to travel by myself? I can remain in much better constant touch, and that's a good thing. All right. So, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? So, some young reformed ladies are prone to discouragement due to lack of suitable marriage candidates. What are your thoughts on alternative approaches such as online dating? First, as it presents itself to us, this is a very real problem in our circles. Basically, I think it has to do with several things. There are demographic pressures. This is not just true in the Reform world. It's also true in the Christian world. It's also true out in the secular world. It used to be that the average age from getting married was 21, 22, thereabouts. Now it's 27 or 28. And the reason for it is because of the collapse of sexual standards, right? The collapse of sexual standards, and you can summarize it, why buy the cow if you can get the milk through the fence? Why commit yourself for life when people are giving it away for free and not requiring any commitment and not... And so this is a pressing problem. But the ratio of the number of men and women born, that's not changed. But the ratio of eligible men, that has changed. Men who are taking responsibility. And this is, I'm going to say something that seems like, this is going to seem counterintuitive, but bear with me. The reason men schlump, the reason they don't stand up tall, is because women let them. Right? Women settle. And when women settle, men settle further. I remember Nancy told me that she wanted a daughter-in-law. She wanted our son to marry a woman that he had to stand up tall for. She didn't want our son to marry someone that where respect would come super easy for her. Oh, you're so smart, she wanted a challenging, educated, smart woman with high expectations, so that our son would have to stand up tall in order to be a leader for her. I had the flip side problem with my two daughters when we provided them with a high octane education, a classical Christian education. They both are, my daughters and my son are, thanks to the grace of God, are superbly educated. Now we knew when we were educating our son that the more educated and checked out and equipped and talented he got, the more we were increasing his options, right, for marriage. With our daughters, the more we were doing that, the more we were decreasing them. Does that make sense? All right. So what happens is that young ladies say, I think I'll play dumb. I think I'll relax if I have any hope of getting married and that sort of thing. I think that attitude of settling is one of the reasons why, this is when women get lazy, one of the things they discover is that men are always capable of getting lazier. Okay? They'll run circles around you. And I think women need to expect a lot. I would urge them to expect a lot. I would urge them to have high standards and don't mess around with anybody that you don't respect. The Bible requires husbands to love their wives and wives to respect their husbands. And I told my two daughters, I told them, look, I don't want you to even think about a guy unless you respect him more than you respect me. Just forget about it. Now, you might say, of course you make the necessary adjustments for age and experience and that sort of thing, but he's got to be the kind of guy where allegiance transfers readily from father to husband, where she looks up to her dad, and the more she looks up to her dad, the more she's able to look up to the right kind of guy. And I'll just say one other thing. It's a bummer not being married. It's a bummer having years go by and not having anybody come around. But I can tell you that it's a bigger bummer to be married to a schlub. Marriage doesn't fix anything in that regard. It fixes one or two things, but just don't settle. And because we have a culture of women settling, expecting less and less and less, the men go along with that. Please give a practical / case study of lowering the standard. Okay. Case study of lowering the standard would be something like our family never watches any movies at all except on the weekends, and except they have titles like Bambi Meets the Smurfs. Okay. And we run it through three special filters, and, you know, because, you know, we never do anything like that. And we're just that way. And all the kids look like they've been sucking on a prune, and everybody hates it. And they spend all their time looking over the fence longingly at what the other kids get to do. You have already lost. You've already lost. It's not a victory that everybody longingly wants to be like the kids at the public school. That's not a victory. And then if you're just counting the days down to when you're 18, and then I've seen this happen where kids get out of a restrictive environment where they had the standard imposed on them, but they didn't come to love it. And then when they get out on their own, as they will do, they fall all apart. They don't have, and then they get into all the stuff that the parents were trying to protect them from. It'd be far better. Now, on the other end, obviously, I'm not saying that you ought to, as a family, be watching hard R movies and watching a bunch of gunk for the sake of lowering the standard. What I'm saying is that it's more important for the family to be united in what they enjoy and what they detest. It's more important that they be united in that and have the same reasons for that. And then, if it's a little sloppy, and you say, that movie we watched together wasn't so hot, we need to raise the standard. That's fine with me. Please do. But everybody goes with you. All right, you talk it out together. You work through it together. That would be an example. Obviously, one other thing. You can only lower the standard on house rules. You can't lower the standard on God's rules. God's rules: you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. God's rules are God's law. You need to worship the Lord. God's rules you don't get to tinker with. House rules, like what sorts of things, dietary standards for the house, how the house runs, entertainment standards, how much time you devote to homework. Those are all house rule sorts of things, and that's where you have the authority to adjust the standards so that everybody loves it. Could you give a few practical examples of how to let the peace of God guard our hearts and minds rather than attempting to guard it ourselves? Here's the practical example, and this is the thing that will stick in your throat and will illustrate that this is what needs to be done. I mentioned it briefly in passing in this talk, but you present your petitions to God, right? You present your petitions to God, as it says in Philippians, and you thank God and you rest. The practical thing you can do, I said in passing, have a psalter or a hymnal and have some psalms of thanksgiving, psalms or hymns of thanksgiving, and get the psalter out and sing it. Sing it aloud. You know, you mean with my voice? Yes, sing. Present your petitions to God with thanksgiving, and the peace of God, which passes understanding, will guard your hearts and minds. So you make a decision to thank God for His deliverance, whatever it may be. So you say, but suppose the plane crashes, or suppose our business fails, or suppose this happens, and it's happens because these things are outside of my control and it just happens. Then you say, if such is to be the case, Almighty Father, I give you thanks. I thank you for the future failure of my business. I thank you, it says in Ephesians, always and for everything, giving thanks. Everything. All things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. God, if the prognosis, I've just been to the doctor, if the prognosis is negative, I give you thanks. I give you thanks. And then you sing. And you say, but that's a bummer, right? I want to go to my grave moaning and complaining about it. Well, Jesus says, you can't add a single day to your life or a single inch to your height by worrying. It doesn't do any good. You're like a little kid in that little rocket ship outside the grocery store turning, you know, you put the quarter in and they turn the wheel, but it doesn't steer anything. Worrying is like that wheel that is not connected to anything. All right, so the practical example would be vocalize in an incarnational way the thanksgiving that you need to render to God. And you will find that you do not want to do that. Right? And that means that's the sticking point. That's the sticking point. That's where you say, oh, that must be the thing I need to do. What is a helpful way to discipline a teenage son-ish, 15-ish, when he does still have particular sins he struggles with? Bossy, unkind to siblings, sibling brothers, etc. This is a great question. I'm glad I have a chance to address it. When I said yesterday that you have a tight standard when the kids are little, and then you relax the standards as they grow, what you have is how do you enforce the tight standards when they're little? Well, discipline for a 2-year-old is made up entirely of artificial consequences. The consequences are artificial. So you swat them when they start to toddle off toward the street to run out into the traffic. You swat them with that's artificial pain. It's real pain, but it's artificial consequences over against the real life consequences of running into the traffic. Sometimes they get through little kids are swift and sneaky. One of our kids got the little metal axle from a toy truck or something and stuck it in a light socket. And their report was, a giant touched me. So that's begins to go toward real consequences. You have contained, packaged, artificial consequences for little kids to teach them the concept. When you start lifting standards as the kids get older, as they're getting older, you should be merging into real life consequences. Because that's what you're preparing them for, right? What would happen if they were 5 years older and were at work and they did that? What would happen there? What would their boss do? Well, he'd require them to apologize to their office mates for having been snarky that way. You'd say, "Aunt, you can't do that anymore." There'd be real life consequences. I found also, and this is particularly the case with boys, we tried not to have our kids say that they were sorry because they might or might not have been sorry. We had them say, "I was wrong." That's objective. Right? That's objective. I was wrong for saying this. And furthermore, the added bonus is that boys hate saying, "I was wrong." they just hate it every fiber of their being. I can be sorry, but deep down inside, I was right. Basically have real life consequences. If they bust something, they pay for it. If they bust something irresponsibly, they pay for it. If it's just normal wear and tear, it's just the household eats it. But if they broke something because they were disobedient, they make restitution. Those are real life consequences as opposed to the artificial consequences. And it should be something that you talk through and everybody understands and signs off on. Many fathers in the courtship movement abuse their veto powers and are extremely picky about suitors for their daughters. They have standards almost impossible for young fellows to meet. A lot of daughters who want to be godly and obedient to their dads get hurt and are single and lonely because their dads turned away good guys for minor flaws. When, if ever, is it right for a daughter not to submit to a father's decision about the suitability of a guy? This is very true. We've seen this sort of thing. There are fathers who are extremely picky and picky in unreasonable ways. Unfortunately, but the only solution I have for this is for at some point the church to intervene, the elders of the church to intervene. Unfortunately, oftentimes guys like this, men like this, don't belong to churches. They live up in the hills and they have names like Ezekiel One Tooth. And they demand their daughters to be absolutely submissive to them, but they will not submit to anybody. Do you see that? That's the problem. And so, of course, if a daughter is trapped in a situation like that, at some point, depending on how tyrannical and how bad it is, I believe a daughter may escape. You make the necessary adjustments. You may leave at a certain point. No human authority on earth is absolute. The authority of the church is not absolute. The authority of the state is not absolute. And the authority that God has placed in the family is a true authority, but it's not absolute. If, however, the family is a member of a church and the daughter is trapped and dad has said no to good guys, or like guys I said yesterday would be better husbands than he's being a father, then I think it's fully legitimate for an appeal to be made to the elders of the church, to the pastor of the church, from the daughter or from the wife, or from the daughter and the wife, saying, could you please provide us with some direction and counsel here? And it's tragic that I've encountered this sort of thing. There are fathers who do abuse their authority, and daughters should not fly off and do something different for light and transient reasons. But there is a line past which I think it's reasonable for an appeal outside the family to be made. God places different governments among men as part of His check and balance system. How would you address the issues of pornography if you find out that the young man your daughter is courting has a problem with it? Say he is godly in that he has met all the other criteria of yours and your spouse's, i.e. Christian, hardworking, appears to truly love your daughter and has admitted to his struggles, not having been caught. Would you write this potential young man off, potential man off? No, I would not. I would not write him off. And this goes back to the previous question of being too picky. And this is going to sound, I need to have you work with me here. And again, these, I'm going to take ballpark numbers. There are 5% of unmarried Christian men who have porn problems, have the kind of porn problems that will not go away after marriage. Right? Let's say 5% that will not be largely addressed by marriage. That kind of person has some sort of fundamental problem, his relationship with God, his relationship with his parents, a detestation of his mother. There's some deep-seated issues with that kind of guy, which are going to be way more than sexual, right? It has to do with despising the image of God. There's something deeply wrong. And of course, when a young man confesses to the father of a young lady that he's had troubles with this, the fact that he's busting himself, the fact that he's answering the question honestly, means that he's much more likely to be in the 90-95%. Okay, and that is most young men, especially in our society, when they hit adolescence, when they're 13 years old, and they get married 9 or 10 years later, and that's getting married on the old timetable, right? Basically, the fact that they have stumbled in this area or that they've had a problem in this area does not disqualify them from marriage. Hear me carefully here. It's one of their qualifications for getting married. It's why they need to get married. They must get married. Paul tells them to get married. He said, dude, you need a woman. and if he says, but Paul, I know, but they're all saying no because I've had this struggle. I'm not able to contain myself, or I have for stretches of time, and then I periodically fall. I have this problem. Now, what the father needs to know is that this young man is going to treat his daughter right. He needs to know that he's going to treat his daughter right, and he needs to be assured that he's not in that 5%. He needs to be assured that marriage is going to be a genuine blessing to him and to her and that sort of thing. But the fact that the young man is talking honestly about it is a good sign, and you should return the favor and talk honestly about it and say what the concern is. So this is an area where we need to be hard-headed and not prissy, not Victorian, not overly pietistic. We need to recognize that one of the purposes, the Puritans taught there were three purposes of marriage, the propagation of a godly seed. They taught it was for companionship, a companionate marriage, and they taught also that marriage is given in a fallen world so that we would have a fence or a guard against immorality. When you discourage marriage and you say, you don't want to be like the you don't want to be like the bank that will loan you money after you've proven to them that you don't need it. Right? You go down there with all your papers and show them all the money you've got and say, I don't need your loan. I don't need your stupid loan. Now will you give it to me? And they say, oh, okay, now that you've proven to me that you already have the money, we will give you some more. Well, the young man comes to you. He doesn't just love your daughter. He doesn't just want to raise a family. He needs your daughter. He needs to be married. He needs protection against immorality. He needs that. And you can't wave a wand and say, I want the kind of man, who doesn't need it at all. That's a disqualification for marriage. So if I'm talking to an engaged couple, and I say, as I periodically do when they come to see me, especially if they're away from home and they're courting in Moscow, I say, so are you keeping your hands to yourself? How are you doing? You've got a month to the wedding. Everything doing okay? And if they say, oh no, we haven't had a moment's temptation, really. You know, things are going swimmingly. You've been engaged for 5 months and you haven't touched anything or wanted to touch anything. You haven't done anything like that. No, we haven't even occurred to us. And I'd say, you had better not marry each other. You had better not get married. Now, I hope you understand that I'm not indulging sin, but sex is God's answer to sexual temptation. All right, that's the fundamental gift, means of grace that God gives us to resist sexual temptation is marital sex. Lots of it. That's what God gives. And we have turned it upside down. No, most young men who are being honest with you are going to be honest with your daughter, and you want to encourage, you get more of what you subsidize and less of what you penalize. And if you penalize honesty, you are going to get less honesty. And I think we've just handled that whole thing, wrong. Strong-willed mothers. Brought up by loving spanking, now discovering she has issues, staying patient and likes to be in control, now repenting of her sin, but no longer trusts her instinctual discipline judgments. Strong-willed 3-year-old boy responds to force control, spanking by fighting tantrums, offended by control being snatched away, or things being forced upon him. So, how much is spanking a one-size-fits-all technique? Is the only way to gracefully shepherd a strong will to force it into compliance via unending discipline sessions? Loving, shepherding, prayerful, etc. Discipline technique book recommendations. First, I don't think spanking is the only thing that you do, but I do think for little kids it's the sort of the central tool in the chest. But there are other things that you can do. So, for example, when one of my granddaughters was 2 years old and she had sort of wanted to seize control of the situation, her dad just took her in the, it happened at our house, he just took her in the back room and sat with her and held her while she flipped out. And he just held her until she was done. Right? You can't do that. I'm not going to let you do what you're doing. I'm not going to let you have control. You're not going to get what you want. So there's discipline, putting a little one down. If they're dry and fed and everything's fine, you put them to bed, and that's the discipline. You just put them to bed and you don't reward them. Or you hold them. Or you make them make restitution to the sibling that they were in a conflict with. Sometimes you spank, sometimes you don't. You play it as it lays. I think this is a wise question in that if you spank woodenly for every offense, 1 swat for this, 2 swats for that, 10 swats for that, I think that that's unlikely to work. Also, since this is a mom and a son, I would encourage you to not let it become adversarial. Don't let it become adversarial where he's the enemy and you're on your side and he's on his side. That's part of why it's developed to this point. If a 3-year-old boy is probably aware that you're a girl, And doesn't, I remember having this talk with Nate. He was two or three. And I said, Nate, is one of the problems that you don't like doing what a girl tells you? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, I understand. I feel your pain. But tough. I wanted, whenever they dealt with their mother, to see the looming shadow of dad right behind her. And that when she disciplined them, she was doing what I asked her to do. And a boy can, without dishonor, submit to his mother if dad's backing up.
Just to kind of play off that, when you're gone all day, what's the best way to handle that without issuing a second punishment when you get, you know?
Yeah, right. What you need to, one time, it depends on, one of the things you can do is set him up. So it's a day off and you don't tell him it's a day off. And you just go down the block to work on your laptop and in your car. And he thinks you're gone to work. One time, we live in Moscow, which is a small town. Nate was two. She put him down. He got up. She spanked him, put him down. He got up. She spanked him, put him down. And she knows how to spank. It was five times. So he decided, okay, this is time to make my move. Time to seize control of the situation and wrest control of this household away from the girl. And so Nancy called me after the fifth time and said, I'm having this showdown with Nate. What do you want me to do? And Moscow's a small town. I said, I'll be right home. And so I pulled into the driveway and Nate was sitting in the living room on the couch thinking he'd won. I could see through the picture window. Thinking he won. And when I pulled into the driveway, I saw this little head hop off the couch and make a beeline for the bedroom. And he got the spanking of his life. And that was sufficient. One time was sufficient because I backed her up. So I would say, I agree with you. You don't want 7 hours later to have, discipline round number two, because one of the things, discipline should be swift and you, it's over and that sort of thing. But if you have a standing problem with this, I would conduct a sting operation.